This is the MagicWordPodcast.com.
Hello, this is Scott Wells for the MagicWordPodcast.com. Well, this week's episode is brought to you again by the Friends of the Magic Word, and I want to thank each and every one of you listeners for tuning in each week and listening to this podcast, and in particular, I want to thank those people who have joined the Friends of the Magic Word and received some pretty cool perks along the way then also by donating either on a one-time basis or an ongoing pledge each month, and it can be in any amount, and all that is appreciated, which allows me then to do a lot of things that we do in producing this, because this is really just a one-man show of me producing this whole thing and promoting it and all the equipment, et cetera, et cetera. But also, from time to time, we have contests in which that we will then mail out some of the gifts that have been provided by some of our listeners. I'm sorry, some of the guests that we've had. And in particular, that we just had a contest recently with Tom Peterson offering a couple of his excellent lecture notes. And we are going to announce the winners of those two lecture notes at the back of the podcast here. So stay tuned after this chat with Paul Gertner to hear if your name was read or if you know the person who had won this. And if you didn't win, we will be having other contests coming up in the near future. I've got some other things actually that have been given to me by some other speakers, some other guests. And so if you are signed up for the newsletter, then you're the first to find out about it and get to enter the contest early that way then as well. But as I was saying about the Friends of the Magic Word, it's because of their donations that we're able then to mail out these things free of charge domestically then as well. And so that helps to defray our costs, again, just which will be the mailing cost of those things, because anyhow, thank you guys very much, and I appreciate it. Well, this week we are going to be talking, as I just kind of spilled the beans and mentioned, of course, Paul Gertner is going to be our guest. He and I actually were just returning from the Johnny Thompson Memorial Service that was held out in Las Vegas, and it was kind of an in-and-out trip for both of us, basically, and we, after the service was over later that evening, both he and I and some other guys were invited to go to David Copperfield's private museum and have a tour by both David and Chris Kenner. And that was awesome. And we'll talk about that in an upcoming episode as to what all went on, because that was really epic. But as a result of that, going on into the wee hours of the morning, we finished up around 3:30, and the flight was going to be about 6 o'clock. Well, I didn't know that Paul was going to be on the same flight as me. I was returning back to Houston, Texas, and he was on his way to Houston as well. And we had a layover in San Antonio. But anyhow, we met at the airport. I had checked in my car. Anyhow, we got there, and I thought, well, we've got a little bit of time. Why don't we just sit and chat? Because there are so many things I've been wanting to talk with Paul about for such a long time. And actually, there are some additional things I would like to have talked about, and we'll discuss that on the back end over here. But I've always said he's the ultimate showman, and what I mean by that certainly is that he is the person who has it all together. I mean, he has been on the television shows, including Johnny Carson, I mean, going way back in The Tonight Show, as well as That's Incredible, and some other kinds of TV shows, early TV shows, and of course, then on Penn & Teller Fool Us on their show. And then, of course, he is the guy, that is, Paul Gertner, is the guy who is the trade show guy, you know, who has been doing this since 1975. So he's got a lot to offer there. And of late, he's been doing some one-man shows. And so he talks in this podcast a little bit about how he has developed those shows and produced them and put them together and finding the venues and everything. And currently he's got, I believe it's called Miracles and Other Deceptions, which is playing in Boston. It's been running for about a year. And you can go to the website at themagicwordpodcast.com and you can follow a link that will take you to that website of his where you can find out more information, get tickets, etc. Well, enough from me. Let's hear more from Paul Gertner, because, again, we were at the airport, so you hear a little bit of background noise, but we were in a quiet corner, and so it's not really too obtrusive as far as some of the announcements and things that you hear in the background. So please welcome my guest here this week, Mr. Paul Gertner, here on The Magic Word. Hello, Scott Wells here for the Magic Word Podcast.com, and we are in Las Vegas, and I've got somebody here with me that I was wanting to talk with for a long time to actually sit down. I thought perhaps it might be at the 4F convention we were going to be able to do it, but looks like time is pretty good now because we both happen to be here heading to the same place, heading back to Houston, Texas. And, of course, I'm talking about, you don't know until I tell you, Paul Gertner. Hi, Paul.
Hey, how you doing?
Doing fine, thank you.
So very little sleep on both of our parts.
That's very little sleep, that's right.
If any.
By the time this gets posted, we'll have our sleep finally caught up.
Okay.
But we are just here in Las Vegas, and we've been celebrating the life and times of Johnny Thompson. And you were on Fooless and had won twice.
Yeah,
bookends.
Yeah, like yeah that's true. Right, yeah. Right, right.
And tell me the story about how originally that they were going to do your trick, but they didn't want you.
Yeah, well, that's true. I mean, Johnny played a big part in it. Because, you know, initially I'd heard through a friend of mine that they wanted him to do, he had presented a video with some magic on, and one of the tricks was Unshuffled, and that's the one they wanted. The producers loved the trick, and they were planning to have him do it, but he called me to say, hey, Paul, you know, I'm just telling you, you know, asking
Johnny
basically,
told me this, yeah.
Well, no, my friend Lee called me and said, hey, you know, they want me to do Unshuffled. And I says, yeah, I'm a little uncomfortable about that because, you know, it's kind of a trick I've been doing for years. And he said, that's how I feel. He said, they just saw it on my reel. So essentially when I talked, I called Mike Close, and Mike says, yeah, here's the situation is that, you know, the demographic for the show is younger, is 18 to 35. And this was before I was on the first time, and they don't have too many folks
our age
on the show. And he said, but let me run it by the producers again and see what happens. And basically, 2-3 days later, I get a call from Johnny Thompson saying, Paul, we want you to do Unshuffled on the show. And I said, well, Johnny, they're planning to have somebody else do that trick. And he said, no. I explained to the producers, if they're going to have that trick, they should have the originator do it. And that would be you. And that's how I got on. You know,
so he wasn't just pulling strings; he was really pushing for you. Too.
I think so. I think both Mike and Johnny were, but they, you know, I think having Johnny wait behind Mike's position too, maybe swung the deal, and it got an old guy on the show.
Well, the several cool things about it, but one was the fact that you had fooled him with it, even though that's a published effect that you have put out. But you had some little.
I just added a little kicker and just changed it after the name of the card said Eight of Hearts or King of Spades, whatever it said.
Right.
Then I shuffled them one more time, and it said Penn and Teller.
You know?
And as I asked the question, did this trick fool Penn and Teller? So I added a little kicker, and that's what we did, which of course, Josh Jay and his company and Andy Gladwin, they put out as a little packaged DVD with a little gimmick. And
what did they call it?
And so,
what do you call
and it?
It
was called Unshuffle Kicker.
Kicker.
Yeah, Paul Gertner's
Unshuffle
Kicker. Yeah.
Now, that was last season or two seasons
ago?
Boy,
that was like three seasons ago.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
And so did you come back the very next season, or how did that work as far as the recall?
I came back. They called me again for the next season, and I pitched the cups and balls
with
a little kicker, which I thought might fool them, but that one didn't fool them. They took a guess and were pretty close, and so on.
Close enough.
And but it was a good, you know, I added a little thing with a Coca-Cola can at the end of it, and which was fun. So that was the second time, and then the third time I went on one more time last season and fooled them again with another trick that involves some dealing and so on like that, and a name trick.
It was a card trick.
Card trick.
So it was the cards that fooled them, not the cups and balls.
Yeah, that's true. When you think about it, yeah. Cards both times for me. Yeah,
that's kind of funny.
Yeah. So,
so you're on three different seasons.
Yeah, three in a row.
I don't think that there have been any other magicians on, but three. I mean, a guy's been on a couple times.
I'm the only one that's been on three times now. So, so I think there have been four of us that have fooled them twice.
Yeah. You've broken a lot of barriers there. I mean, not just with age.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. When Richard went on and fooled them, we both were thrilled, you know, because we called each other up and said, hey, the old guy's got on. You know?
That's fantastic. Now, whenever that they do that, I know that every once in a while that Penn and Teller are kind of talking. When it gets close, then they just get like one chance to kind of come to guess what it is.
Yeah, that's true, because they're only seeing the trick once.
Right.
And that's what the people like, that, you know, sometimes people go on YouTube and they watch a trick 10 times and break it down frame by frame,
completely
put it
different.
In slow motion, yeah. And then they say, why didn't Penn and Teller figure this
yeah.
trick? Well, because they don't get 10 shots at it, and they don't get to watch it in slow motion.
They're doing it in real time, and it takes seconds.
Real time, and they've got about 10 minutes, and yeah. they're coming back at you. You
know? It seems like I've heard a couple of times in which that they say, well, we think it's this way, and the guy who is the magician is not quite sure if he understands, and then it's like, I guess Johnny's talking to their ear and says, hey, you know, I think that's they fooled you.
Yeah, sometimes that happens, mm-hmm. and where Mike or Johnny would of course have given the... nope, you were fooled,
right.
Or nope, you weren't.
So they're always working in the background.
I mean, yeah, but they're in the background, but they're not talking to, Mike and Johnny aren't giving, we're never giving any input
correct.
into
right.
the
right.
method. Yeah.
Now, as I understand it, then also that really that when you were saying that they were just, Johnny was just kind of pushing for you, but they just make recommendations because it's the producers ultimately, I guess, who make the decisions?
That's my understanding is yeah. that, they're trying to put together a good TV show,
sure, sure.
And if, no matter how good of a card trick somebody might throw at them, if they have too many card tricks, mm-hmm. maybe they need something different. And
right.
So I think there are a lot of variables. I'm sure they love to have, just coins and cups and balls. So I think it was in my advantage when I pitched the cups and balls because, there have been a few sets on the show, but
right.
not too many.
Right.
Not too
right.
many.
What year was that? Did you publish the, was that Balls of Steel that was the book?
The Steel and Silver? Steel and Silver. Yeah, boy, I don't know, 97 or something like that.
I was thinking it was in the 90s sometime.
Yeah, I think it was back in 97, okay. something like that.
Now, that was something that you were keeping to yourself. I mean, even though that you've been showing it around and going to conventions and everything, but did you ever see anybody else who was using that routine?
Yeah. A few people have sent me videos.
Have they?
And that have done learned the routine and done it fairly well.
Yeah,
and they like it.
It is a good routine. I mean, mm-hmm. obviously, and that you've got a good story, and the way you present it, it makes sense, being from Pittsburgh. And
yeah, it's worked well for me, and I use it, I actually use it in my little theater show I do, the one-man show I do, mm-hmm. as the closing piece,
right.
and it's tied into a sort of a tribute to my steelworking dad,
right.
and so on like that at the end.
That was one of the things I was going to talk to you about. First of all, on some trade shows, but also, I guess, that you have... you're staying closer to home by doing the one-man show.
Yeah, we moved to Boston, and we've got a couple grandkids up there. Mm-hmm. And
That was
the incentive. We also have two granddaughters out in Denver. Can't be in two places at once.
That's right. Each one can't be one place, and you can say.
Yeah. So we're in Boston for a while. Who knows? Could be in Denver. But, started doing it. There's a really lovely, it's actually the oldest hotel in America. It's called the Omni, the Parker House Hotel. It used to be the Parker House. Now it's the Omni Parker House. Mm-hmm. And it's a classic hotel downtown Boston, right on the Freedom Trail. And so I've been doing a little show there Friday nights. And but it's a close-up show. It's not a parlor show. It's a close-up show.
Seating about how many people?
I see 36 okay. is the max. And it's the first row has 12 people around the table.
Around the table?
Around the table, literally at the table. So we sell those as at-the-table seats.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, people do come and stand behind me. Toward the end of the show, I invite people to come up and watch the cups from wherever they want. And then we have a second row, and then the taller bar stools for a third row.
Okay.
And, yeah.
Is it something that they present, like, weekly, monthly, or how often?
Oh, yeah, once Friday, every Friday night.
Every Friday.
Almost every Friday night. Sometimes I'm booked somewhere else, or sometimes a mm-hmm. company comes and buys out the show and says, we want you to do it, at our hotel or our, business, and so on. So at least two or three Fridays a month.
Do you rotate different tricks in and out?
I kept the same show for the first year, all last year, and just this year I started adding a couple new pieces to the show. And there's one brand new, the Fool Us had asked me about maybe coming on again, and they asked me to send another trick in, and so that could happen next year. So essentially I'm rehearsing.
For a potential
return
of
unprecedented time. I actually perform it at this show as if I'm doing it for Penn and Teller. I turn one guy, you're going to be Teller and you're going to be Penn.
That's
and
funny.
And I have to do it that way because of the nature of the trick, which uh-huh. you'll understand when you see the trick eventually, which you might see sooner than later.
Okay. I understand. And now this is different from Brain Drops.
Yes, okay. Yes, yes.
Now, that was more of a stand-up show, Brain Drops.
Brain Drops, yeah, was more of a one-man stand-up parlor. Yeah, mm-hmm. Kind of a parlor, one-man show.
And why did you evolve from that to the close-up?
Mainly because Brain Drops was involved a lot of iPads and iPhones.
Right.
Video camera, a couple screens.
A lot of techie stuff.
A lot of tech stuff, yeah. And to be honest, it got too not necessarily labor-intensive, but too anxiety-intensive to do in a one,
some things you
one man
control.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And in a one, you know, for a one-nighter. I thought, I initially designed it to be able to do as a one-nighter.
Yeah.
It was fine if I got a theater and I was doing it for a week or two where everything was set mm-hmm. and there were other people in case something screwed up.
Yeah.
But when I was doing it as a one-nighter, it was me. And if now fortunately nothing happened ever, but if a camera went down or if something, there was a lot of moving parts to the show.
Okay.
And it just wasn't worth the time,
and
effort,
the stress.
And the stress
yeah.
of setting it up for a client, and yeah, so, but I'm still, I mean, I actually grab pieces from Brain Drops that are now part of the new show.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now,
yeah.
Was the Brain Drops the first thing you did before you had the new, the close-up show?
I
thought you had another show before
I had another
that.
One, Ten Fingers.
Ten
yeah,
Fingers,
I had another one, Ten Fingers, which was sort of an autobiographical one-man show, and actually, I've grabbed pieces from Ten Fingers and from Brain Drops, and they're now inserted into this.
What's
new
this
show.
New show called?
Miracles and Other Deceptions.
Okay, Miracles and Other Deceptions.
The Close-Up Magic of Paul Gertner is sort of a subtitle,
yeah.
And but it's a fun show because it's in my I'm in control of it now. It's not, there's not as much technology involved because I don't need it. I have 36 people; they can all see, and I really wanted to do a show with just close up because that's what I do best.
Are you kind of feeling like you've hit your niche right there then after the last couple of attempts?
I do. This is perfect for me.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not a stage guy. I do stage all the time, but I if given the choice, I'd rather do a show for 36 to 40 people
right.
close up around me. And it's a 75-minute show, no intermission, straight
just
through.
One show, not two.
And I do two shows a night.
Okay.
Yeah, so I have to reset mm-hmm. pretty quickly. And there are a lot of reset.
Parts,
yeah, a lot of moving parts to reset. So as I sort of jokingly say to the audience, who when they come for the second show, I say, now, you know, did a very quick reset. Hopefully everything is in the right pocket. And you and I will discover if I was successful at that exactly at the same
that
time.
That is good. That's good. Yeah, so the second audience sees something a little bit different, potentially.
They could. It's happened a few times.
Well, live and learn, I guess,
yeah.
You know, about
yeah.
how that works.
But it's fun.
Yeah. And so with doing that, you're kind of learning along the way. Is this something that you want to, you know, go out and do on the cruise ships or something, you're thinking? Or?
I don't think so. The show right now that I'm doing up there is probably just going to stay in Boston. And
you're not going to take it on the road or
I don't
or
intend
season,
to, yeah. No. I sort of jokingly call it my retirement gig.
Yeah.
So, I don't want to retire because I love performing. But I do want to maybe pull back a little bit from some of the crazy traveling that we're doing right now.
Yeah.
You know, why? Yeah. My wife will say, why are you getting a 6 a.m. flight? You know, I said, well, I have to. But so I am pulling back a little bit, but I still want to perform. So, you know, eventually I'll probably do, you know, maybe two Fridays a month. Just hopefully it will have enough traction to keep it going that way. And that'll be fun.
We'll see where that goes.
Yeah.
And now, I know there are a lot of people who are listening to the podcast and thinking, you know, I'd like to do something kind of like that also. How would you how did you go about this? And what would you say to recommend that other people should do if they're looking to do something similar to this in their own cities?
There's the persistence aspect of just simply trying to find a location, you know, talking to every hotel and explaining to them what you wanted to do. Some are not even interested. Some will, you know, give you a space, but the price that they want is way beyond
just
what
prohibitive,
you could.
Yeah,
exactly. And but I think besides that element and so on like that. And I was very fortunate, though. I had the luck of, I got a little plug-in for the show. The show had been going for a couple months right at the same time that I was doing Penn & Teller for maybe my second time or whatever. But I got a plug-in for the show
mm-hmm.
right at the end, and which, you know, hey, I have a Friday night show in Boston. Well, that's helped a lot. in terms of driving people to see the
wow,
show.
Okay.
That was really, really good. But the most important thing, I think, is it's got to be the show has to be, the material has to be very, very strong. And that's where I'm getting repeat business is, I mean, I've had some people come, one lady came 4 times already, and she brings back new people each time. Somebody else bought out the whole thing, all 36 seats, boom, done. You know, here's my credit card, you know, and so on, bought the whole thing out. I've had people come from out of town to Boston just to see the show, you know, and that's nice because the hotel is realizing that now I'm starting to generate revenue. They're staying at their hotel, they're eating in the restaurants and so on, and hopefully maybe the hotel will be a little more promoted. Promoted a little more. That'd be nice.
It would be nice. You know, that Jamie Salinas and I had done a thing that we called Top Talent Productions, and we had the hotel that we used the same location all the time, but we were not always assured by the hotel that we would have that room available. Same with us. We looked around a lot of different places to find, you know, something that was going to host us, and they said, you know, it was going to cost, I don't know, $1,500 or something, you know, for the room, which is, as you said, it was prohibitive, but they said, well, we can do it for like $250 if we can only give you like 30 days notice, which you don't have much time to promote it.
That's
And that's like maybe on a Friday or Saturday, so it's not like a regular every Friday or every Saturday.
Right.
So they really didn't work with us on that.
Yeah.
But one other thing I always thought would have been to their benefit would be, why not promote this by having flyers at the registration desk or putting them under their doors or something and saying that if you see the show, then, you can have dinner in the show or a weekend package at the hotel, you know, with you and your spouse, that this, you know, you get breakfast or dinner in the room and breakfast in the show. And they got some sort of a package they put together, and they kind of partner with you. But we couldn't get that going there in Houston.
Yeah, I have not been able to. I mean, I think I've not been able to do that yet with the hotel. But I think that they're starting slowly but surely to say, you know, wow, you know, every Friday night there's a show here, there's a lot more people in the bar, and they're realizing that. And
how long has this been going on, though? A year now.
Yeah, I started last March 15th, so it's been going a year.
2018.
It took a while, you know. I mean, at first I was only doing one show a night, and then when the Penn and Teller thing hit in July, I added a second show, and it's been good. Initially, I wasn't sure I had the energy to do a second show, you know, because
after you started doing it, you realized, hey, I'm up.
That's it. That's what happened. Mm-hmm. So now it's not a problem,
right?
You know, I mean, I still have no idea how Copperfield can do what he does, that many shows in a week,
and then give a tour what
and
he
then
did,
do what we just saw.
Yeah. Oh golly, it was amazing until 3 a.m. Well, you know, you have to have a lot of stamina, certainly, whenever that you're going to be on your feet doing trade shows all the time. And you've been doing that
for
a long time.
Since I think I made my first trade show in 75. Yeah. So.
And Bud Dietrich was one of your mentors?
Oh, sure. Yeah, Bud. I watched Bud. And Eddie Tulloch was first. And, learned a lot from Eddie.
I was just talking with Shep Hyken recently, and by the time this airs, I think that Shep's will have already been posted. But he was talking about how that he was getting into trade shows and then also doing speaking and then phasing out the trade shows, so he just does speaking
only. Right, right.
But just saying that he can't charge the same kind of price for his magic shows he was doing that he was going to be getting for speaking.
Oh, sure, yeah.
And I think that that's the same, not just for trade shows, but just in doing something as a keynote speaker, you know, where the people can come in and with just a file or a notebook or something, you know, as opposed to wheeling in an origami. You know?
Right.
And get a pretty good pay. Do you do some speaking also?
A little bit, but not anything on the level of Shep.
Yeah.
He's on a whole other planet and so on. And
in other words.
Yeah, they've concentrated on that market, and they do really good jobs at it. Yeah, I just never felt as comfortable on the stage like that. You know, I sort of, you know, loved my close-up.
You like what you're doing.
So.
Now, don't you prefer actually talking with the public when they walk by and doing one-on-one as opposed to doing the larger illusions in the trade shows? I do, personally.
I've done the larger illusions in the shows. And the only one I have left now, I mean, I've sold all that big stuff except for the origami. I have kind of one of the original origamis early on. And I still use, but I haven't done it in a trade show in years. And because I really don't even pitch it.
It's, I was going to say, you have to sell that too.
You have
don't
to you? Sell it. Yeah, you have to tell them about it and so on. And it's in the box in case they look at the video and say, "Oh, can you still do that?" Okay, if you really want. Mm-hmm. But it's just, you know, the hassle of the doing the illusions and shipping it and all that. It's just I'm just.
Do you see many other trade show guys who are doing bigger illusions like they used to?
Not as much now. I see most of the guys I see doing more of the close up. Uh-huh. You know,
and some mentalism.
And their mentalism is, that definitely has become bigger.
Yeah, it's easy to carry around, obviously.
Right, right. Exactly.
Same like with a deck of cards or whatever, you know, and coins. Yeah. But it's got to play big, and you got to stop the crowd.
Yeah, but I mean, like Walter Blaney, always, he would do the big illusions in the trade shows. And I had one of his, the box with the swords in, the
shadow
flashing
box.
Lights, yep. The flashing light, the brilliant design. And I used that. Often, you know, in the past, but not anymore, though.
Did you ever get one of his ladder suspensions?
I never did. That was one illusion that I kind of always wanted, but I just never had a client. Usually I tried to have a client buy them for me, and I just never had the right situation where I could say to the client, here, you know, buy me this one.
Yeah, that's how I sold mine, actually, because I bought one from him, and I was performing it a lot. Oh, and then some time went by that I wasn't using it, and Walter and I talk all the time there in Houston, and he was saying, hey, I've got a guy who wants to buy it, really wants one, and he said, are you really using it? I said, you know, I think I will sell it, but what would it cost for me to buy a new one from you? Because by that time I'd had it for maybe 5 years, and you know, I think Dan Summers was making them, or is now, you know, the hoops and everything. Anyhow, point was, you know, I said, okay, well, I'm going to charge more. And the guy who was coming in from Florida was saying that, hey, I'm just going to pass this on through, so whatever, you know, you want to put on it, then, and I said, well, I don't want to put, like, a used price. I want to put a brand new price. He said, fine with me. And so I said, all righty then. So I went and bought a Jaguar afterwards when I got the money. But anyhow, yeah, that's a great illusion, you know, his ladder suspension that he had built. But as you say, the brilliant design, that shadow box, the sword box in the shadow.
Yeah,
thing,
with the lights that flashed.
Yes, right, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I think he called it the Great Escape.
Yes.
Is that what he called it? Yeah. Yeah.
Yep, that was great. Well, so as far as the trade shows go, that most of what you were doing was within the continental United States or in Canada?
Yeah, occasionally I'd do, you know, Germany and Paris, something in France and the UK, but never did Abu Dhabi or some of the guys, you know, have done.
I was close to that.
Yeah, I've not been over there yet.
Yeah, the airfare is what kind of seem to be prohibitive.
Is that right? Pretty pricey.
Whenever I was talking with him, because I was quoting a price, and I said, here's what it is now, and I said, it's going to be going up, you know, I don't know, it was like $1,800, and that was early 2000 or something, round trip, and I said, but I need to get the contract signed, or it's going to be $2,000, you know, and that's just, it's not even business class.
Well, I think Charlie McFarlane has a client that has him going over there all the time, though, I think,
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
Good for him. I know that he's cut back from some of his shows he's been doing, intentionally so, too, you know.
Yeah.
Where he's wanted to be more of an MC, you know, and which is another thing. Do you ever, aside from trying to attract a crowd, do you ever do the talks also?
You mean, like, which kind of talks?
Well, what I mean is, you know, so like what I've done sometimes where they'll say, rather than introducing a speaker and, you know, stop a crowd to introduce a speaker, you do both. That's right. So then you kind of pitch the product, and you have a slideshow and everything that goes along with it as well.
I've done that, but I only used to do that for one client that I worked with for a long time.
And you knew their product
Pitney
well.
Bowes, and I was familiar enough with the product that I didn't feel, uncomfortable. But the only other time I did do that was for when I did it for a brand new client, but I wasn't using an ear prompt or anything like that. It was just memorization, and it was way too much memorization. You know, I mean, I should have had an ear prompter for it, and I didn't. It just, I never did that again. You know, I always told them I had Dale Allen. There was a young lady I worked with for many years, and I would just slot Dale Allen. If they wanted a speaker, Dale would come right behind me. We'd work together as a team. And she was great, and she would use an ear prompter. And so she could do anything they wanted. Yeah. So
I once used one of those Axtel drawing boards. You know what I'm talking about, with the mouth moves and everything. Yeah. Because whenever I bought that, my idea was that it is a checkerboard kind of a thing, a design where that it's perfect for a graph. You know, talk about sales. You know, kind of going, because it's a grid on there basically. Mm-hmm. So I could talk a little bit about the product. And then when I started drawing the character, then the mouse started moving. I had that recorded, so I didn't have to memorize a lot of script. I would ask some questions, I would just move my thumb and then hit the recorder, you know.
Mm-hmm. That's great. That's great. Yeah.
And so I only did that for one client one time. It's always great whenever that they say, like when a person who's walking by your booth and will say, wants more information. Well, don't you work for them? I mean, it sounds like, more information than what the clients or the salesmen do over here.
Right, They assume you're with the company.
Exactly. Well, today I am.
Yeah. Just for these days.
That's right. Did you ever really specialize in one particular? I mean, for example, I know that Charles Green III would specialize in pharmaceuticals, and I really like the energy business. I mean, I understand the shop talk. I mean, every industry has its own shop talk. Yeah. Do you feel like you have an industry or two or more that you specialize in?
Now it seems the medical and the security businesses are coming on. That's where I'm going to for a show in Houston. It's a new security thing next week. It's another security device kind of high-tech company. Early on, though, I did do a lot of pharma. Pharma was big for a while. And early on, it was all the, being from Pittsburgh, most of the shows I did started out being like the Iron and Steel show. And they were technical shows for the iron and steel industry, engineering shows, plant engineering and maintenance shows. Pretty gritty shows for, equipment shows and so on like that. Yeah. Not high tech necessarily, but the kind of
utensils.
Equipment on the steel mill floor,
Correct.
And so I did a lot of shows like that, and you pick up one client like that, and that leads to more clients like that. So that would be the, I kind of specialized in those clients early on.
Did you always solicit other clients while you were at a trade show or not?
I would sometimes at lunch keep an eye out and walk, not necessarily go up to them, but keep. I would find certain ones that if I could, get the names and so on like that. But usually, not a whole lot. Only, from the standpoint that I always felt a little uncomfortable in the sense that if you're there at a show, and all of a sudden I'm at another exhibitor pitching them to use me, I often wondered, why wouldn't they think that if they book me, I'm going to be working their show out hustling other business? So there was always a little bit of a fine line to walk there, I thought, for me.
That's a very good point. It's kind of like, I guess, that if somebody is cheating on your wife, wouldn't you think that once did you marry that person, you're going to be cheating on her too?
Right.
I see what you're saying. But do you go around, though, to the nearby booths to say, hey, that it might be kind of crowded here, or that make sure that my sound is not going to be, if it is too loud, let me know, kind of start to make friends with them?
Yeah, I would always introduce myself to the booth across the aisle and on the sides early on to say, hey, when I'd be there rehearsing. And they'd say, what are you doing with the cards, So, I'll be doing a presentation, it's going to be good for everyone in this area because I'll draw some nice crowds and so on. Feel free to grab the crowds, They're when they leave me here, they're going to be walking different your direction. And in other words, I tried to put a positive spin on the fact that, I'm going to have a nice size crowd twice an hour in front of our booth.
Yeah.
And make sure you take advantage of it and so on. And if you did it that way, then they thought it was a good thing, as opposed to them getting annoyed that, you were drawing a big crowd and they weren't.
See, because sometimes they might say, well, that really was helpful to us, and next time maybe that we'll have you also.
And that happened. Mm-hmm. That would happen, sure.
And whenever you're negotiating with them, do you, I assume, give like a bulk discount? In other words, that, hey, you booked me more than once or twice this year?
Early on, I used to do that and try to, get the clients to line up, four or five shows a year, because I knew they were going into more shows. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But for the most part, I found it really didn't matter. They were going into the shows. They wanted you. They were going to use you anyhow.
True.
And I sort of pulled back on that. So.
What about the footprint that you make? In other words, that I know that they usually lay out their booths to say, you know, that we're going to be having this and that, and we're going to have the sales and the products over here. And so there's really not a lot of room necessarily for the magician, unless it's based around magic or something.
Right. Yeah, I mean that's an important thing to make sure they know that you don't take up, you know, a ton of space in the exhibit, that, you know, just by being on the edge of the aisle, you can kind of use part of the aisle to draw the crowd and
right.
so on, which technically you're not really supposed to do at a show. You're supposed to have that crowd completely on your turf. But, you know, most shows will not shut you down for that. That can happen, though, where they come and say, hey, you know, you're drawing too many people here. You got to move in or move your stand
it's
further
fire
in
hazard
the booth.
Or something? Or?
I think it's just more general show. If you look at general show rules, it says you're not allowed to have activities and so on like that are going to attract, you know, a crowd and block the aisles. Mm-hmm. You know, the rules are in there, but they don't always enforce them.
Well, that's true. You know, I've used a fire wallet, and I'd rather ask for permission, or rather than ask for permission, just ask for forgiveness, you know.
Yeah, and I had somebody recently, I do this cups and steel balls, and when I tap the steel ball and the cup together, it sounds like a bell.
Oh, uh-huh.
Okay. And I had one show person come by and say, you can't do that. And, you know, ding, 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 ding. Why? It says in our show rules, no bells or buzzers.
Wow.
In other words, they didn't want carnival kind of things. They said, we don't want any bells and buzzers
oh,
or able
see,
to use. And essentially, that's like a bell. You're ringing a bell. It's as if somebody were ringing a bell. Hear ye, come,
right.
come to our booth.
Gotcha.
That was in the show rules.
Mm.
And they identified my cups and balls as a bell,
yeah,
as a source. Yeah.
Interesting.
So I just didn't, I worked it out with them that I wouldn't do that sound thing. And, you know, I would do it lightly.
How do you get around some clients that will say, well, we don't want bait and switch, and we think the magic might be deceptive, and, you know, I mean, they're kind of battling it out. If you're trying to sell a client on magic in general, and they're, I mean, how do you overcome something like that?
I mean, I've had that happen in the financial industry where, you know, somebody might
right.
see it in a show, and then they say, hey, we pitched it to our company, but we've got some people in our VP's office who feel that they're going to think that we're going to be cheating them because you're doing magic and
right.
you're, you know, doing cards, and maybe they'll think that if you're cheating them, maybe we're cheating them. So, you know, quite honestly, I don't even try to fight that. You know,
if they've got a mindset, you're not going to try changing.
There's exactly. I mean, it's move on to another one. You know,
yeah.
I find.
The reason I ask that is because I talked about Charlie McFarlane a little bit earlier, that when he was saying that he could tell that a client was wouldn't move away, or they said, okay, well, we've been doing this for the last 2 or 3 years. We want to go in a different direction. We're going to stop using magic. He would have a different angle. It seems like he would always come and would continue, and he kept clients for decades, you know,
mm-hmm.
as a result of that.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I mean, trying to repackage it and give them another, let them see a different way they can use it. I did that with Pitney Bowes a lot with, you know, we'd do the close-up performances, then we'd turn it into a more of a little mini stage show. Then I'd sell them on the idea of the origami in their booth.
Yeah,
we'd do that for a year or two, and then it was back to the close-up. And so, but you know, I worked with them for 30, 35 years,
mm-hmm.
and but then, you know, the marketing director leaves, and
I know what you mean.
Goodbye.
or particularly like in energy business, you know, one company acquires another one, and so
that
company's gone, and so, yeah so long.
Yeah,
you know, one of the things I really like that happened fortuitously for me one time is they said, well, you know, it's a 3-day show, but the first day, the local guys want to try and sell it themselves and do what they have been doing. They think it's been successful. And then they will measure that against what kind of crowds and business they do when you come in, you know, for the next couple of days. And within 2 hours, they said, you've done more business and brought more in
mm-hmm.
than we did all day yesterday on the first opening day.
Yeah.
So it's like, okay, sold.
Yeah.
That's what you want to hear.
That's what you want to hear. Yeah, no doubt.
But it's that's the kind of thing I think sometimes that you have to overcome. And if even you could get these guys and gals to go around and see other magicians and what they are doing at other booths and how they are attracting, you know, I think that that'd be helpful too. Years ago, I remember in the success book, that Francis Marshall had written, and they were talking, remember that?
Oh, yeah.
And they were talking about keys to successful trade shows, and magicians are pretty far down the list. It seems like there were celebrities and other kinds of things that people should be getting first, but as far as their marketing effectiveness, the magicians were, you know, it didn't show them very high. Now, of course, when was that out? In the 60s? I mean, that was a long time ago.
Yeah, but then there was another report that I think the Trade Show Bureau did, and this was probably in the 80s, and magicians ranked, I think, possibly second after product demonstrations. So needless to say, everyone grabbed that study.
Of course, yeah.
And that became kind of, for the magic world, I remember Eddie Tulloch and Bob Stodell, who was Eddie Tulloch's agent, would use that, and I used that, and everybody used that to say, hey, you know, we're generating. Now, is it measurable? That's the hard part, you know. If trade show magicians can measure their worth and actually go in with a PowerPoint presentation and prove that we are generating X amount of dollars, there's where you could really, you know, change everything, you know. But it's very hard to measure exactly, you know, where the sale has come from. And it's happened once in a while. And
that's true. You know, Charlie McFarlane, again, had told me that one of the first times that he had done a trade show and not knowing what to charge. And he just said, well, I don't know, so I tell you what don't you just give me 1% of anything that you sell that can come back and be shown as a direct result of my sales pitch and getting them into the booth to talk to the salesman. And within just like a half a day, you know, the vice president came over and said, we're going to have to renegotiate. We just sold $500,000, and the guy didn't know that, you know, our pipes did this or whatever, and he came over and asked some questions that you had essentially planted in his mind to ask, and as a result, we wrote a big contract. So, yeah, we're not going to give you $50,000 or whatever. It is kind of hard to measure the effectiveness. I mean, advertising, that's always kind of a difficult thing, and not just necessarily for trade show magicians. So has there been any new data that's been shown that you've seen or read?
I haven't seen anything lately.
Since the 80s.
That was back in the 80s. I'm sure that
about
came out.
Somebody needs to do
somebody should do a little.
Joshua Jay does a good job.
Yeah, that's right. They should do a study on something like that and give magicians some ammunition. Because I still think, there was a time where I thought, maybe it's going to fade away, you know, and the whole trade show magic business will...
Have you seen ups and downs?
Yeah, we've all seen ups and downs, especially in that, whenever it was 2007, 2008, 2009, where the economy went in the toilet and everybody saw the pullback. But, you know, I wondered sometimes, you know, is it going to fade away or something? I still think as long as they continue to have shows, there's, you know, I mean, I still am getting this client I'm coming to Houston to work with tomorrow, I'm willing to bet that they think this is a brand new idea, and they saw me at a show, or I don't know, maybe I sent them a proposal and so on like that, after they requested some information. But to them, they're really excited about this idea of a magician in their booth. And it's not a new idea, but if it's new to them,
it's new to them. That's
you know,
right.
Right. And I think that will continue because the people change, the marketing people change. And, you know, while it's, you know, when I got into the business, it was guys who were my age that I am now in my 60s who were the marketing directors. And they weren't going to retire because they were flying all around the world, having a good time, eating on an expense account.
Right.
And now it's a much younger group who are the marketing directors, but they're changing, and so it keeps changing. So I think if anybody's out there listening saying, you know, is that still going to be a market? Could I make a living doing that? I would not have made a living in magic without doing the shows. I really probably wouldn't have. And
I've always thought the trade shows is the most lucrative. Well, maybe now cruise ships, I guess, also. But I think that trade shows would be the most lucrative on a steady basis.
Well, I think that for me it was the consistency. I mean, I got married fairly young. I was 23. I had kids pretty early. You know, I was 25 and 27 when I had the first kid and second kid. So a big part of it to me was I saw friends who were working in Las Vegas, and, you know, I had dreams of that a little bit, and there's people working in, you know...
Yeah, you had the big show with the plumes and all that, you know, the
I did, I tried, you know, that a little bit, and, but early
and
on...
you won FISM, too, didn't you?
I never competed with that act at FISM, but I did win FISM with Close Up, with Close Up, and first place, and, but I did win some other awards with that act, and it was cute, and so on like that, but nevertheless,
That wasn't going to be the thing that was going to take you to the next step. You realized that really it was going to have to be trade shows, and you started...
Yeah, and it was the consistency of the work. It was the fact that, you know, I was going to have a family to raise and to feed and through college and so on, and I realized that I could book the trade show for Pitney Bowes, and if they booked me for these five trade shows, or they were more like 10 a year I did with them, they would do the same 10 next year. And if I did a good job, they'd call me, and they did. And that became a consistent income stream, as opposed to if I had gotten a job in Vegas for 6 months, or then the Bahamas for 6 months, or in the Crazy Horse Saloon in Paris for 3 months. And that'd be a little harder. I don't know that my wife would have put up with that one.
That's a little bit different. If you're a single person, or you kind of have that lifestyle, you know, and you don't have any children, and your wife is kind of also a nomad and ready to travel, that's a little different.
But it was different. The trade shows certainly were more closer to the normal, a normal job in terms of
get to come home for the weekend.
Executive that worked for a company that could, you know, could come home.
Yeah, and you can kind of also set your own time as far as if you want to take vacation.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, and I did like that aspect. I mean, I've never had a job. I've never worked for anybody except for myself, and I've enjoyed that freedom.
How many people did you have at your peak that worked for you?
At one point, it's weird, but yeah. I mean, I had sort of the group of magicians that worked the trade shows that I was... The early ones on were... Early on, I was using David Williamson and Tim Conover and Charles Green and Harry Levine, Mike Rogers, Lisa Mena. Those were all the ones I'm picturing on that sheet paper. I had all these, and I wasn't keeping them all busy, but there was all enough business coming in that they were all getting some work with different clients and so on. And I guess I had maybe three people in the office was the biggest. That was the most I ever got. I had three myself, and then two full time and a part time. In the office.
It's another contracts and all that.
Make phone calls. I had somebody do more sales and someone doing the office work and so on. And that went fine for, 10 years or whatever like that. And then eventually, I could, when that hit came, I could see I could pull back and I started doing more of the shows, and I wasn't using the other people as often.
The bubbles start to break. Bit at some point.
Absolutely.
I think you're going to start to call our flight to board here shortly. I believe that is us over there. Well, okay, as we start to close, we're going to go over and board. Name of my podcast is called The Magic Word Podcast. So what is your magic word or phrase? What is your philosophy of life? What do you live by? What's important?
It's just the passion. I mean, I'm doing what I love, and that's kind of what drives me. And that's what's worked for me, is finding something you like.
So whatever you do, have a passion for it.
Have a passion for it, because if you like it, have a passion for it, you get good at it. And if you get good at it, people pay you to do it. And if you get really good at it, they'll pay you pretty well.
Thank you very well. Well, very, very good. Thank you, Paul. I appreciate your time very much. So for the Magic Word Podcast, that was Paul Gertner. This is Scotty out.
All right, so now we're back with Paul. Actually, that we have gone our respective places, and some time has passed since you just heard this first part of this podcast. We were together at the airport, and now we're back together, actually via Skype. And hello again, Paul.
Hey, how you doing?
Fine, thank you. So listen, there were a couple of things that I wanted to talk about, but unfortunately our time was running short when they were announcing the gate for us to board the plane. But one of the things was going way back in time in our Wayback Machine over here when you were on the That's Incredible show. I think it was Fran Tarkenton, and I'd forgotten who else was on the show.
Yeah, gosh, I don't know. I was on the show twice.
Oh, were you?
And so I'm not sure. Yeah, so I'm not sure which one, who was on what, but I remember Fran Tarkin. I think I borrowed his ring to do the Ring on the Hourglass, a version of the Ring on the Hourglass. And then I was also on them with John Davidson and Kathy Lee Crosby. We did a big thing outdoors with $100 bill and the whole thing. Well, and it was a hot air balloon trick.
Well, that's the one I remember. And I want to talk about for a minute because I remember, I think you had posted this on your blog then as well, because I thought this was kind of a funny story, but a sad story in a way then also. Could you share that?
Oh, yeah. That was when I was doing a version of the borrowing $100 bill. I ripped a corner off. And I set it on fire. But before what happened, just to sort of set it up, I had a package, a sealed package that was sent out to That's Incredible's producers. And it said, do not open, save for Paul Gertner's appearance or something like that. And so they had this sealed package. Mm-hmm. And we gave it to Kathy Lee Crosby in a blue pantsuit. I don't remember.
Wow, like it was yesterday.
I have photos of it. I had my cousin come, and she did shoot a few photos, so those are somewhere around.
What year was that? Approximately 80-something?
This would have been like in the 80s, yeah. It was right before I was on Tonight Show, so the first time. This would have been like 84, 85.
Okay.
Things like that, yeah. And I handed Kathy Lee Crosby the package, and we were in a big field, and she went and jumped in the basket of a hot air balloon that slowly rose in the air, and it was tethered behind us in a far shot. And so the balloon was there behind us real far in the field. We were real, 100 yards in front of it or 50 yards in front of it, and you could see the balloon in the background. And then I said to John, I want to borrow a bill, and I borrowed $100 bill. I ripped a corner off. And the basic concept of the trick was rip the corner off, hand it in the corner, took a little blowtorch out and burnt the bill. And at the end, the bill was found inside the hot air balloon as they lowered down the package. And it was a little plaque that said, in case of fire, break glass and smash the glass. Mm-hmm. And there was the $100 bill inside the glass.
Yeah.
And that was the end of the trick. However, what happened in the middle of the trick during my presentation, I borrowed the bill, ripped the corner off, handed him the corner of the 100, took out the blowtorch, and my presentation was, the bill is not really burning, it's just an illusion, as I actually burnt the bill. That's not really smoke, it's just an illusion, you know, not really heat, it's just an illusion. And then the bill burned into little pieces of ash, and I said, and just like the ashes or the smoke in the air rises in the air, the hot air bill is now in the balloon, and they lowered it down. However, right after we did the shoot with the burning part, the director says, cut. He says, I want to do a close-up on the bill burn. And I was ready. You know, I had another 100. Mm-hmm. And we took it on, and we did it again.
Okay.
And he says, cut. He says, okay, let's do another take on the bill burn. Cut. Let's do another take on the bill burn.
Jeez.
Cut. And, yeah, and after the fourth take, I literally I was down to my last $100 bill because I only brought 5 of them. And because I said to Kathy, I said, you know, how many times did they want to do this? She said, you better have a number of them. So I did. And I called the director over, and he says, how many more times we got to do this? And he said, what's the problem? And I said, well, you know, every time we do this trick, it's costing me $100. And I'm only making like $375 for the shoot because it's union scale job here.
Right.
You know, I'm already underwater. And he says, but he looked at me really puzzled, and he said, but you're not really burning the bill. It's just an illusion, right? And I said, I know I say that, but no. And he got the message, and we got it on the next tape. But as I said, and I mentioned in my show, actually, and at the Omni Parker House in Boston, I mentioned, you know, watching that $500 go up in smoke was worth it because that was a video I sent to NBC to try to get on the Tonight Show with Johnny Carson, and that was one of the videos I sent out there, and to try to pursue the getting on the Carson, which actually worked, you know, because it helped me get on the Tonight Show with Johnny.
Well, I was thinking that It's Incredible was a Carson production. I thought that he had seen that and then contacted you, but actually you had solicited him. Okay.
Yeah, no, see, because That's Incredible was an ABC show.
Oh, that's right.
That was on ABC, yeah.
He was NBC.
And Carson was all NBC, so two different channels and two different networks. But what happened with Carson was kind of interesting because, so I had this video from That's Incredible, and then I also added something. Oh, that's what it was. I also had done something called Magic Moments on HBO.
I remember that.
And
yeah,
there were little
with Dick Cavett, right?
Exactly, with Dick Cavett.
Yeah.
And they were little vignettes they would play in between commercials once in a while.
Yeah.
And it was a great group of folks that did it. I mean, it was everything. Derek Dingle.
Slidini.
Carol Fox and Slidini and myself, David Roth, I think did some. It was just a good group. John Cornelius, I might have even done. I'm not sure if John was or not. But so I also sent a video of the Bill Byrne, or the dollar bill trick, $100 bill trick from That's Incredible. And I added the That's Ridiculous, the coin trick on the Johnny Carson tape, or for the, from my HBO spot.
Yeah.
And I put those two tricks together because I didn't want to send them a lot of stuff. I think, I'll try to impress them that I was on That's Incredible and show them a really good coin trick. I don't even think I sent the cups and balls for some reason. I just wanted it to be very short and sweet.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I sent out to NBC. And then I remember calling them after I sent the video out. And I said, did you get my tape? And there's this dead pause. And the lady says, sir, we get 5,000 tapes a week or something. Like it was some ungodly number.
Yeah.
And she sort of says, well, if we see something we like, we'll be sure to call you back. Kind of patronizing and hung up, but very nice, you know. And I figured, I didn't have anything to lose. So
yeah.
I made a decision in my head. I said, I'm going to treat this the way a salesman would treat it. I'm going to call every week. And I did. I called every Monday. I think it was every Monday or every Tuesday, whichever Tuesdays I think it was.
Mm-hmm.
And I call every Tuesday and say, hi, I was calling to see. I'm the magician from Pittsburgh. I sent you a video. I'm calling to see if you looked at my video. And it was like, no, we'll, I'm sure we have it in the pile here. We'll get around to it. And thank you for calling. Click. But I just kept calling each week. And I think after about 3 months.
Wow.
That's
persistence.
It was persistence. I figured I didn't have anything to lose. They said, they says, we looked at your tape. You're the magician from Pittsburgh, right? Yeah, that's me. That's me. And they says, we looked at your tape and you're very good. And maybe there was a few other things on it or that, but they said, but that's all we can do right now. They says, we're going to, if Johnny asks about magic or so on, we're going to show him, we'll show him your tape, if he's looking for a magician.
Uh-huh.
So I figured I was making some headway,
sure.
And I believe I called back the next couple of weeks in a row. And they says, you know what? They says, we showed Carson your tape last week or 2 weeks ago or whatever it was. And they said, and he came in the office. He was raving about your magic. He said, you're very, very good. And they says, but, they said, they mentioned specifically, they says, because Johnny's been playing around with coin tricks in the office. You must have done a coin trick on that video that really impressed him.
Mm-hmm.
And that was, that's ridiculous. And I said, and they said, but that's all we can do. They says, this was like the talent coordinator, Jim McCauley, I think I had talked to, at least by this time I was actually getting to the talent coordinator. And they says, we can't do anything more than that. They says, because Johnny makes all the calls about any magicians on the Tonight Show. They says, when it comes to comedians and so on, us talent coordinators were involved, but when it comes to magicians, that's Johnny's one. He makes all the calls.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember getting off the phone and I said to Kathy, I says, I'm kind of stuck. They told me they did everything they could. He even looked at my tape. He liked my tape. And I says, I think I know what I'll do. I says, I'll send Johnny Carson a personal letter from me and I'll write it direct to him and I'll send it overnight. I'm going to use that new FedEx thing, that overnight FedEx stuff. It was, a little more pricey, it was going to be $6.50 or whatever it was to send this overnight letter to him.
Yep.
And I says, I'm going to send it overnight and he'll get it the next morning. Let's see if that helps. And she says, Kathy says, she says, I don't think you should do that. And I said, what do you mean? She says, well, Johnny Carson knows what you want. She says, the question here is, what does Johnny want? And I said, what do you mean? She says, well, didn't the producer say he was doing coin tricks in the office and he liked your coin trick? And I said, yeah. She says, Johnny Carson wants to be a magician again. She says, send him a letter, talk to him about magic. Don't mention anything about being on the show. He already knows that. Mm-hmm. And that's what I did. I sent him a letter. And I said, you know, Mr. Carson, thanks for looking at my video. You know, I mentioned That's Incredible, and I, you know, mentioned the coin trick, and I started talking about coin palms. I says, you know, I don't know if you ever played with that, but, you know, for that trick, that's ridiculous. I do, you know, I'm using an edge grip, a multiple edge grip of, you know, six coins to start, and I'm doing a, you know, one fingertip drop off one at a time under the cars. Basically, I explained the trick to him.
Yeah.
But technically, he probably really didn't understand multiple edge grip or some of the stuff I was talking about. It didn't matter. I sent the letter out, and I called up the day after it got there. I sent it out on Monday, called Tuesday for Scott McCulley, Jim McCulley, and I says, hey, did you get my letter for Johnny? He said, yeah. He said, I've got it right here. He says, really nice note. He says, I'm going to be in the meeting with him, and I'll give him your note, Paul. And he read, you know, I left it open so he could read it. And he saw that it didn't mention anything about being on the show. Just was a personal letter to Johnny about being a magician, doing coin tricks. And literally about two and a half, three hours later,
wow,
I get this phone call. And it says, oh, Mr. Gertner, could you please hold for a moment? Mr. Johnny Carson's on the other line. He'd like to speak with you. And damned if he didn't call.
Wow.
And I got on the phone. I spent maybe 10 minutes with him on the phone. But the very first thing he said was, Paul, you're doing beautiful magic. I really appreciate your note. He says, I can't do a multiple edge grip with six coins. And he says, damn, I'm lucky. I'm classic Palma coin, but you're doing beautiful stuff. And I really, really liked it. And we talked a little bit. And he says, you know, when are you coming out here? When are you going to be in LA anytime? And I said, well, technically I am. I'm coming to a show in Anaheim about 3 weeks from now. And he gave me his number. He said, well, here, let me give you my number. When you get in town, if you have some time, he says, maybe we can get together. And I made sure we had
time. Yeah, uh-huh. I think we can make some time.
And I called him that Sunday and ended up going out to his house and had a 3-hour magic session Sunday, which was my rehearsal day for the trade show.
Well, now, wait a minute. Back right there. As I recall, that's part of the cool story, I think, too, where you were in the cab pulled up to the gate. Yeah. Start from there.
Yeah. Well, what actually happened was, you know, when he gave me his number the first time, when he gave me his phone number when on that initial phone call, and he said, give me a call when you get in town. I had no idea what that meant. All I knew is I was going to sort of schedule it so that there was time, because he said, man, maybe we can get together or something. And I assumed it meant I was going to go down to his office.
Studio,
and I was going to meet
right.
him. And that's my assumption. So I got there that Sunday, and I remember renting a car. I had a little budget rental car, went to Budget, and, you know, I rented a car and had some little tiny little thing, I'm sure. And then I went to the phone booth, and this was payphone time.
Yeah.
You know, there were no cell phones. And I called Johnny and says, you know, Paul Gertner, and his housekeeper answered the phone, and she got him, and he got on, and he says, Paul, you know, it was a Sunday afternoon, like 11 o'clock and 12 noon or whatever. And he says, hey, you know, Paul, I'm glad you called, you know, and it was him.
Wow.
You know, he's on the other line. And talking, he says, well, what are you in? You're in town for a few days? I said, well, yeah, I'm in town. He said, well, you got some time now, or what's today look like? And I said, well, it's my rehearsal day. I just have to show up in Anaheim, you know, later on this evening. And he said, well, why don't you want to come out the house? And I says, okay. Okay. Yeah. He said, you got something to write with, Paul? Here, I'll give you some directions. And so he gave me directions to his house on Malibu Lane. Or Malibu on Wildlife Road in Malibu. And he gave me directions to his house, and I shakily wrote them all down.
Yeah.
So I'm like, and he said, you got a car? I said, oh, yeah, yeah, I got a rental car, and I'm all set. He said, okay, you know, he says, well, so it's going to take you, you know, an hour and a half or whatever it was. He says, I'll see you then. He says, just come to the gate, and just the guy at the gate will know you're coming, and he'll buzz you right in. And I remember going back to the rental car guy, and I says, could I get a map?
Yeah.
Sure. He says, yeah, where are we going to go to? I said, well, I got to go to Malibu. He says, oh, Malibu. Oh, the rich people.
Yeah, they're really rich people in this case.
He says, who are you going to? Where are you going to Malibu? I said, well, actually, I'm going to Johnny Carson's house. There's this dead boss, the guy behind the guy. What? You're going, what? I said, well, I'm going to Johnny Carson's house with our car. He says, what do we rent you?
Yeah.
And he grabs my contract and looks at the key. And says, you can't go to Johnny Carson's house in that. He says, wait, let me set you up. He got me a big gray Cadillac. He says, you're going in a Cadillac.
Wow. Yeah.
So he did. He switched cars. He says, there's no charge. He said, but you can't go to Johnny Carson's house in that little Chevy or whatever. And so he switched me to a big Cadillac, and I drove up. And got there, and the gates, yeah, the guy, Mr. Gertner, yes, okay, just a second. The gates drove in, pulled in, and Johnny gates opened up, and it was very big home. Obviously, grounds were gorgeous. It was like a conservatory and everything, and plants everywhere. And then the gates opened, and I parked, and as I was trying to figure out where to go next, Johnny comes out in white tennis shorts and out the front door, and hey, Paul, how you doing? You know, shook hands and went in and had about a 3-hour magic session.
You got your stuff out of your trunk, and
I grabbed a little case of magic and went in, and So we had a very, very cool magic. That was the first time, probably there 5 or 6 times.
And then after you had a session for a little bit, and you said, well, I know you got to go. Do you need to use the restroom?
Yeah, that's true. That was the time that restroom story happened. It's true. There was the very end of it, and he says, "Hey, so you said you got to drive to Anaheim." He says, "You want to use a John or anything?" I think that's the term he said. Mm-hmm. "Do you want to use John or the restroom? Maybe the restroom." And I didn't really have to, but I thought, you know, how many people been in Johnny Carson's bathroom? So I said, "Yeah." And he said, well, it's just right down that way, you know, go right down that corridor. You'll see right there at the end. And so I walk in through a doorway and, you know, it's very nice. And there are pictures and paintings and so on like that. And I closed the door because I wasn't in the restroom yet. So I thought, and I walked through the, you know, sort of like a large room, and all of a sudden there's a toilet sort of sitting there. And then I realized, I looked around and said, oh shit, you're already
in the bathroom.
You know, you're in the bathroom. This is the bathroom. So I had to kind of go back and slowly, subtly shut the door so I didn't look too stupid. But it was a big bathroom.
Yeah.
It was a very, very lush, very, you know, everything. But yeah, he had a lot of fresh flowers everywhere and paintings and so on. But it was a beautiful home. And so then I came back out and left. But just as we were leaving, though, it was funny. He was still shuffling the cards when I came out of the bathroom. And he had been shuffling this deck. You know, occasionally he'd pick it up and give it a shuffle or two. And then he says, hey, I'll show you one more thing. And he did one last trick, and it was a trick that had to do with the mathematical aspect. In other words, it fooled me. And I didn't see it coming, and he did it with the deck, and here, take the cards, do this, and so on. And he says, did I get you? I says, yeah, you really did. I says, I didn't see, because I had thought he was shuffling the cards. Here he was doing a nice false shuffle, a little false shuffle with the cards, maintaining a top stock of, I don't know how many would be. And then he just threw out I think he said Royal Road to Card Magic, and he threw out a page number on it. I can't remember exactly which trick it was, but I did go back and look it up. And it was a stacked deck. You know, it was only then that I realized that's what he was doing. He was playing. Yeah, he was shuffling it through the little session, and then the timing. You know, when the timing was right, he sprung it on me just toward the end, and he was kind of tickled.
That's pretty cool.
Another thing too is
I recall. Yeah. Correct me if I'm wrong, but I thought that whenever you were washing your hands, then you had some paper towels that had JC on it. And you thought, oh, I should take one of these as a souvenir. And you thought, maybe not. And then you thought, oh, these cameras might be watching me or something.
I'm not sure I remember anything with the logos on it. No. There were some things. I think there might have been normal towels that actually did have something with a person, like a C. And not the paper towels. I do remember what it might have been was I remember – I remember standing there in front of the mirror and thinking, he used to joke on TV a lot about having the urge to open up a medicine cabinet in someone's bathroom just to peek inside. Yeah. And I remember having that urge. I didn't. I honestly didn't. But I'm thinking, there's the medicine cabinet. You know, there's the mirrored medicine cabinet. It's very ornate. So I wonder what would happen if I looked inside, if there would be like a picture of Carson.
Oh.
But I didn't. But it was, it was quite a fun, memorable
quite an experience.
First little trip at his house.
That's kind of cool. Then how many times total were you on Johnny's show?
I was on the show three times, and and the first time I was on was about 3 weeks after that visit to his house, because I was coming back. I wasn't coming back out to L.A. That wasn't planned, but as I left that day, he said, my people will give you a call, Paul. We'll get you on the show. And sure enough, his people called, you know, a couple of days later, and it was, what's your schedule look like, Paul? And it was, you know, we looked at a little date and fun 2-3 weeks out, and it happened.
You know, they always talk about how the Tonight Show and how years ago and how important that was for people's career. Did you find that after that was on that you got higher visibility, got more shows, more trade shows, or just more notoriety?
It was a different world back then because it was a little bit different. Number one, there was more visibility if you were on the Tonight Show because there's so many millions of people watching. And it created a nice amount of visibility among my clients and so on. However, in my situation, like, it was totally different than when Lance Burton was on. Say, when Lance Burton went on The Tonight Show, he had a stage act.
Oh, he was trying to book seats also, the casino, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, he had this stage act. He wasn't even at the casino when he was on the first time. I think he was probably – Lance was still at the body shop in
L.A. He just finished winning FISM. That's right. Yeah.
Yeah, and he had just won FISM, and he was at the body shop. But somebody could look at Lance's show who had a casino in Las Vegas, like a Hacienda or whatever, and say, or a Tropicana. I'm not sure which one he went through first. I think the Trop. And say, hey, that's a nice 10-minute act. I want that on my stage. Whereas close-up magic was completely different. No one could look at it and say, oh, that's a nice close-up magician. Where could I use him? There was exactly, and there was no market. Now, Johnny was pretty nice about it, though. He said he was very hip to it. He said, Paul, he says, I want to mention, you know, we want to get a plug in here for you about what you do. And so he did. He says, you know, Paul does mostly corporate shows, and the general public doesn't usually get to see him unless he's at trade shows or at sales meetings. So Johnny put that plug in there for me, saying, hey, this is what this guy does, trade shows and sales meetings. The general public doesn't usually get to see him unless he's at those kind of shows. But here's Paul and so on. So that was his idea. But he understood that I didn't have a show. You know, like, it would be perfect if I was doing my little show at the Omni Parker House in Boston and was on the Tonight Show. That's great. That'd sell a ton of tickets. And it'd be fun to be on a show again. I have to work on it, maybe.
Yeah, go back.
And, who is it?
Jimmy Fallon show.
Jimmy Fallon now.
Exactly.
Yeah, I'll have to work on that. But it would be fun but to have a venue. But back then, when you were on, even like when Mike Skinner was on, when I remember watching Mike, I watched Albert Goshman, I watched Alan, Brian. It was, if you did close-up magic, it was a great spot for a video, for your demo reel. It was fabulous that way. It helped with agents. Agents took you a little more seriously. Oh, you were on The Tonight Show.
Big deal.
But again, still a close-up magician had to find how to use that as a marketing tool. And I used it. I used it a lot. But it wasn't like all of a sudden I was getting calls off the show. Oh, you're the guy on The Tonight Show. Boom, business increased a ton. Right. No, that didn't happen for me. I increased my fees a little bit maybe and so on. Maybe not as much as I should have, but I probably I used it as much as I could from a marketing standpoint.
Right. Cool.
Yeah. And that was sort of, you know, I thought the way to do it.
Well, listen, thank you very much, Paul. I appreciate you giving us a little addendum over here as well. Great stories. That was a lot of fun.
Okay.
So thanks a lot. And we will talk to you a little bit later. So for the Magic Word Podcast, that was Paul Gertner. We'll see you later. Scotty out.
Well, that was fantastic. Thank you very much, Paul. I appreciate you being my guest on the Magic Word Podcast. And also, I'm glad that we had a little bit of time there at the airport. We didn't just kill time. We actually made use of the time we had in waiting for that flight. So thank you a lot for the stories that you shared. But if you want to read more about that, he has these stories, I believe, on his blog, which I would highly recommend that you go and visit. And you can access that at Gertner.com/blog, B-L-O-G, all lowercase. And I would recommend that because he has a lot of really interesting information and some good stories and everything if you kind of go back in his archives then as well. And I might also mention that his website is one of the higher rated websites, magician websites in the world, apparently. In fact, that according to a ranking, his website is listed about two levels above mine. I believe I'm 47 and he's like 45. So the Magic Word Podcast falls just a little bit below his. So it's worth checking out at Gertner.com. Again, he's got a blog and everything else that's very interesting over there. So I would suggest that you go and check it out. And of course, Paul is just, as you heard here, just one of the nicest guys. So when you get to see him next, be sure to tell him that you heard him on the Magic Word Podcast. And I hope that you enjoyed it as much as I did. Well, that music normally means that we're going to be having a product review, but instead, this week, I want to announce the winners of the recent contest. And I also want to thank Tom Peterson for donating a couple of lecture notes so that we can provide those to the couple of lucky listeners who have gone through the website that we have and signed up for the contest. So thank you. We had lots and lots of people who were interested in this contest, and so it tells me I perhaps need to have more contests. But anyhow, the two books that are available that are going to be sending out, one is Tom Peterson's Magic Justice, and the other one is Tom's called Atomic Fueled Deceptions. And so, let me announce the winners here this week, and the winners are Matt Alexander and David Woodrow. Congratulations, David and Matt. Your lecture notes from Tom Peterson will be on their way shortly. Well, I think that's going to be a wrap for this week. And so, until next week, stay well, get booked, and remember this, that if you have a passion for what you do, you'll get good at it. And if you get good at it, people will pay you. But if you get really good at it, people will pay you really well. This is Scotty out.